One of the main features of Mahayana Buddhism and Vajrayana Buddhism is the central role played by Bodhisattva vow. So, in those two schools of Buddhism, the fundamental orientation is one of training to live one's life for the benefit of all sentient beings. And this term sentient beings is deliberately used because they don't only mean human beings, they mean all sentient beings. So, a lot of focus, as you probably noticed, is given to the development of bodhisattva motivation. And usually in one's training, one would start by taking the aspiration vow. That is, you aspire to be able to start training in the actual bodhisattva path. I think from what we've done so far, you can see why this is often a wise move. Because we may start out getting a rush of blood to the head thinking, yes, I'd love to be a bodhisattva. You know, it sounds quite romantic. And then suddenly the reality of the situation dawns and you find you're not up to it. Meanwhile, you've taken the vow, so you end up breaking the vow, which isn't an ultimate disaster, but it's not the best way to set about things. So it's not a bad idea to approach the whole subject in a graduated way. First of all, finding out a little bit about what it really entails, then maybe starting with aspiration, and then finally maybe arriving at the point where you can actually take the vow. So the whole process is epitomized in the life of Chenrezig. So this is why it's valuable to look at how Chenrezig developed and what he did and what happened to him. It all started like some fairy tales do, long, long time ago, far, far away, in the time of Buddha Amitabha. So Buddha, it was before Shakyamuni Buddha. And there was this very diligent practitioner. Do you remember his name, Sean? Anyway, he was the one who became Chenrezig. He was practicing very diligently, and Buddha Amitabha was his guru. So one day he went to Buddha Amitabha and he said, I want to take ultimate bodhisattva vow. So Buddha Amitabha said, yes, very good. Go away and meditate on it and formulate your vow fully. So this guy went away and he meditated for 100,000 aeons, I think it was, which I think in those days is basically a way of saying a very long time. So he meditated for a very long time and formulated all the aspects of the vow he wanted to take. And basically it amounted to, I vow to remain in samsara, practicing the activity of a bodhisattva for the benefit of all sentient beings, and I vow to remain here until I have liberated all beings down to the last blade of grass. Now, that was pretty comprehensive. And the focus, of course, is even though the being may be on the verge of enlightenment, they don't take that final step into nirvana. They remain within samsara. So this is a very important aspect of bodhisattva vow at this level. I think you're beginning to get the picture that there are many different levels of bodhisattva vow. And if you look at the Tibetan system, it's very interesting because if you study the stages along the path, there are 10 levels. There are 10 levels of realization that develop progressively with practice. And the 10th level is the being who is on the verge of enlightenment. So a 10th level bodhisattva could become enlightened and enter nirvana virtually at any time. And what they say is the only remaining impediment to complete enlightenment in the mind of a 10th level bodhisattva is the last tiniest traces of ignorance. And if you read the life of the Buddha, on that famous night when he sat under the Bodhi tree, he went through the three watches of the night, and you remember Mara did all his stuff, you all know the story. And when he'd finished with Mara, he then went into the last period of meditation that preceded dawn, and at that time he went into what's called Vajrasamadhi, which is not just samadhi, but it is a samadhi that is totally focused and unshakable. And it is through the Vajrasamadhi that those last traces of ignorance are purified and dropped in the mind, and then enlightenment naturally arises after that. So 10th level bodhisattvas could do this, but because they've taken their vow to remain in samsara for the benefit of all beings, they don't. They don't take that final step. So they're always there. And if you look around, if you look at the Tibetan system, there are 10th level bodhisattvas alive. The Dalai Lama is one. He's said to be a 10th level bodhisattva. Karmapa is said to be a 10th level bodhisattva. And as far as I know, Thaisita Rinpoche is a 10th level bodhisattva. So we have living examples of these very, very highly developed beings who have chosen to remain and continue reincarnating endlessly to benefit beings. So from our point of view, it is a massive sacrifice, because compared with where they could be, samsara is no fun at all. They could be having a much better time. But they have, out of their limitless compassion, chosen to come back over and over and over again to help the rest of sentient beings. So this is the tradition that Chenrezig, or the being that was to become Chenrezig, wanted to enter into, and he spent all this time formulating his vow. So he took that vow before Buddha Amitabha, and he said all the words, all the details of my vow, and then he ended it with, should I ever break this vow, may I shatter into 1,000 pieces. So he didn't really want to give himself a way out. So he took the vow, and then he spent aeons and aeons and aeons liberating beings. And he liberated millions of beings. And after a long time, he thought, surely I must have emptied samsara by now. There can't be many left. So one of the characteristics of Chenrezig is that he has the all-seeing eye. This is why he's often referred to as the all-seeing one. So he could see the whole of samsara. So he checked out samsara, and to his amazement, there were no less and no more beings in samsara than when he'd started. That's exactly what he said. Oh no. And then he followed it up with, obviously I can't do this. And that broke his bodhisattva vow. So then and there, he shattered into 1,000 pieces. And luckily Buddha Amitabha saw this. So he said, oh son of noble family, that's how he used to talk to people apparently. Oh son of noble family, what have you done? You've gone to pieces.
Oh
I don't think it was quite like that. So he said, okay, you'd better now retake your vow. And again, Chenrezig spent aeons reformulating his vow and improving it. So he said, okay, I will retake the vow, but it's going to be bigger and better. And it's very interesting the way he improved it, because one of the things he did when he retook his bodhisattva vow was he manifested himself with 1,000 arms and 11 heads or 12?
11 heads.
11 heads. Now, in the Buddhist iconography, the number of arms and heads indicates the level of activity that the deity is capable of. So the Chenrezig we see on the shrine has one head and four arms. So he's obviously capable of much more activity than somebody with two arms. So 1,000 arm Chenrezig could do thousands times more and see 11 times more because of all his heads. So that is how 1,000 arm Chenrezig came into being, as a result of the original vow being broken and then reformulated. But what to me is more interesting and more important, and to Charlie as well, is that he also emanated a protector, a six-armed protector called Chadrupa. And he listed the activities that Chadrupa could perform. And it was quite amazing, because the protectors of all the deities are the most accessible. So even if you're not very good and holy, if you do certain practices, you can connect with the protectors because they help us with negative energies. But among other things, he said, Chadrupa is going to become the lord of the Bardo. That is the realm we enter into when we die. And that gives him a direct connection with lucid dreaming, because the function of lucid dream is to prepare us in life to dispel the illusion that the dream is real. So we cut through that. And if we can do that and thoroughly establish our minds in that understanding, that realization and that practice, there's a very good chance that when we die, we will attain enlightenment in the Bardo, because we will already have the ability to see through the illusion. And Bardo training is about being able to see through the illusion when you enter the death state. And it is easier to do than it is when we're alive, because we don't have the dulling effect of the physical body and the physical nervous system and the energy systems that go with that. So he said, Chenrezig will, Chadrupa, that six-armed Mahakala, will be the lord of the Bardo. And another thing Chenrezig said is, I've seen that a lot of beings who should be becoming enlightened when they die are not, because of the conditions in the Bardo. Therefore, Chadrupa will be able to help beings when they enter the Bardo if they have that potential. And the previous Kali Rinpoche, who had revived the most important of the Chadrupa practices, six Mahakala practices, was once giving an initiation, and he started talking about the activity of Chadrupa. And he said, if you establish in this lifetime a good connection with Chadrupa, when you die, he will come to you in the Bardo, and he will take you by the hand, and he will lead you to Dawa Chen. So it's a really fantastic opportunity that Chenrezig created, because usually only 8th level bodhisattvas have the necessary qualifications to get into Dawa Chen. So with Chadrupa's help, it seems there's a back door that you can use. So Chenrezig did a huge number of things. And this, of course, connects with the whole teaching on Dewa Chen, which is what they call a pure land, which means it's not an enlightened state, but it's not samsara either. It's between the two. And if you can get born in a pure land, and Dewa Chen is the one closest to the human condition, you are free of all negative and conflicting emotions. So Dharma practice is very, very easy. And you don't have to pay rent and you don't have to buy food. So all the normal distractions that we have to contend with here in our lives aren't there. So you can very easily dedicate all your life to training, to practice. You can have access to all the great teachers because the Buddhas drop in and out of Dewa Chen and Buddha Amitabha lives there, so you can get all the best teachings and you can become enlightened. So it's quite a good deal, and this is why in countries like Japan the biggest schools of Buddhism are what they call the Pure Land schools. They're totally focused on generating the energy while they're alive to becoming born in Dewa Chen. So Chenrezig's activity impinges on all the different realms, but he is definitely available and accessible, and this is why we do the Chenrezig practice, because of all the deities, Chenrezig is the most accessible, along with his emanations like the protectors. And therefore, it's probably, in most countries, the most widely done of the practices, because it's so accessible and so immediate. So, as far as we know, Chenrezig is still here. And the Chenrezig practice is done. And when you do the practice, every time you chant the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, your consciousness becomes connected to the consciousness of Chenrezig. And you become part of that huge energy system that he generated through his bodhisattva vow. And therefore, you are able to channel his energy into the six realms of samsara. This is what's so significant about the Chenrezig mantra. It vibrates through all six realms of samsara. So you are sending out energy to help beings in all those realms every time you say the mantra of Chenrezig. So it's a good way of training for bodhisattva vow. It's a good way of developing some level of understanding of what it means. And slowly realizing that it actually is possible to live totally for the benefit of beings, which includes yourself, without self-destructing. You know, a lot of people, when they hear about bodhisattva vow, become rather disturbed. They think, well, you know, what about me? How will I survive in the world? How will I manage? And when we start asking that question, we usually frighten ourselves, because at a logical level, it's not always possible to see how it can be done. But I think what we need to understand when we start working at this level is that as human beings, we are far more than we realize. And as I was saying this morning, our problem is egocentric fixation. And fixation is by its very nature limiting. We become limited and trapped in the belief upon which we fixate. So if we fixate with total conviction upon the belief that we are limited, inferior, unworthy human beings, we will trap ourselves there, just like the monkey with his hand in the calabash. But our training in the area of compassion and bodhisattva motivation is to open ourselves to the possibility that there is more. Now, we may not be able to say what that more is, but most humans have a sense that there is more than this limited, fixated existence. And the only way to proceed is to open ourselves to that possibility. And every time we do that, new things happen. So it's not a path where you get a guaranteed trajectory presented to you in advance. It's a path where you're constantly stepping into the unknown. And slowly you gather confidence. The more times you step into the unknown and discover that it leads to growth and development, the more confident you become that you can do it and that it works. So through this example, we recognize that the most powerful force in the universe is compassion. It liberates from all conditions. And that is why the strange, it's almost paradoxical training to do what, from an egocentric point of view, weakens us, actually produces the greatest strength. Because it liberates us from the limiting fixation and opens us to our own limitless potential and makes it possible for that to manifest in our lives. So that's what it's all about. Philip?
I just want to know,